From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Bob Oakes, and this is On Point. Scott Pruitt is out. After months of ethics scandals, the embattled EPA administrator calls it quits. Here's CBS News correspondent Bianca Golodriga.
Scott Pruitt, the target of more than a dozen government investigations into his ethics and spending, was forced out today. The president announced in a tweet that he had accepted his resignation.
A trade war is on between the world's largest economies. China retaliates with tit-for-tat tariffs on U.S. goods. President Trump lit the flame at a rally last night in Montana.
I respect China and I respect President Xi, but they've been killing us. $507 billion in trade deficits last year. 507.
3,000 migrant children are still in federal custody, but Health and Human Services Secretary Alex Azar says his agency has things under control.
There's absolutely no confusion on our part. We have the kids, and we are working to comply with the court's order. And this is something we do. We've done this for years and years.
This hour On Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kimberly Atkins, Sahil Kapoor, and On Point's Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. What do you make of Scott Pruitt's resignation? Who will pay the price in a trade war with China? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald. Kim, great to talk to you again. Thanks.
Hi, Bob.
Also joining us from Washington is Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg. Great to have you back as well.
Thanks for having me, Bob.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Jack, always great to hear you.
Hello, Bob, Kim, and Sahil.
All right, let's start with Scott Pruitt out. Growing ethics scandals, at least 12 separate investigations. Donald Trump stood by him as he rolled back environmental regulations, but last month expressed some frustration over the repeated scandals facing Pruitt. But Donald Trump said the resignation was entirely Pruitt's decision. Kimberly, do you believe him?
Well, this may not be the first time that the president says something that's not completely true in this decision.
Oh, that can't be.
So there had been growing frustration within the White House, if not with the president himself, but with a lot of people around the president, as well as a lot of people in the EPA, people who are very strong Trump loyalists within the EPA who saw Scott Pruitt as an increasing problem. The ongoing investigations into things, silly things from trying to get a used mattress from a Trump hotel to really serious potential ethics violations, things that could have criminal penalties being investigated, really getting in the way of the work that the EPA was trying to do in order to further the president's agenda. And they had been for a long time really urging the president to finally get rid of him. Scott Pruitt was very good at sweet-talking the president, essentially, giving him effusive praise whenever he talked to him, making a lot of time to be at the White House. And so the president simply liked him. And that's why he kept him around for so long. The final straw was apparently when Scott Pruitt was urging President Trump to fire Jeff Sessions and to name Scott Pruitt as Attorney General. That was the one step too far, apparently. And it was John Kelly, the chief of staff, who finally made the call to Scott Pruitt to tell him his time was up.
Sahil, do you see that as the tipping point for Pruitt and or Trump?
You know, it seems to me that Scott Pruitt finally succumbed to political gravity after what seemed like a legendary exhibit of scandals and ethics allegations that would have felled pretty much any other administration official we can think of. Others have been fired for much less. People have failed to get administration jobs for much less in their records. There were so many things. It's hard to point to one. There was the sweetheart housing deal from the wife of a lobbyist. There was him trying to get a Chick-fil-A franchise for his wife. There was reports of Pruitt firing an aide who refused to retroactively alter his calendar. Now, there are some reports from the New York Times that John Kelly, the White House chief of staff, has wanted Scott Pruitt gone for some time now, and he called the EPA chief before the president left for Montana to ask for his resignation. So it does seem like he was forced out and not simply willingly left. The president, of course, said he was proud of Pruitt, praised him for his outstanding work, and the president didn't suggest, as you mentioned, that he forced him out.
Jack, I'm wondering, do you think that given the growing concerns that were being expressed about Pruitt from within the political, from within Donald Trump's political and media ally circle, was Pruitt's departure inevitable?
Probably, but, you know, I think he was useful for the president, and I think that's one reason he was kept around useful, because he took the flack for the president. I mean, Pruitt's grifting and grafting was just minor league stuff. The president, in the headline at Vanity Fair, is the grifter-in-chief. Just consider some of the ways he's making money out of his office. At least $175 million in commercial rents from commercial tenants, including the Bank of China. We don't know how that influences his administration. It could. We have the Chinese government granting 39 trademarks to Ivanka Trump. We have USA Today did an investigation that 70% of buyers of Trump properties in 2016 were limited liability corporations, meaning we don't know the owners' names. So who are those? What do those companies want? What have they been asking? What have they been getting? We know none of that, but what we do know is that the president is making lots and lots of money out of his presidency.
So, Kimberly, I'm wondering if you think that with Pruitt gone, Donald Trump gets rid of a big political headache.
I think so. I mean, in terms of the constant headlines, the more than a dozen ongoing investigations, those do go away. I didn't get the sense that that particularly bothered the president himself all that much. One thing that Scott Pruitt's departure does in terms of policy, that doesn't make a lot of difference there. The EPA is going to go on and still continue its mission of rolling back every regulation that the Obama administration put into place as much as they can. And that's, on policy-wise, that's really not going to change. You have that's moving forward, and that will continue to please the president. But I think the president is going to miss most is having somebody who was very supportive of him, one of his strongest supporters, somebody who spent a lot of time with him, praised him effusively. Even that resignation letter from Scott Pruitt was quite remarkable with the way that he essentially deified the president in that speech, and in a way to ensure that the president defended him even on his way out, and that seemed to work as well. So I think that's the biggest loss for him.
Sahil, pick up on something Kimberly was just saying. Do you see any change in the shrinking of the EPA's mission under the Trump administration as we go post Pruitt here for the EPA?
Probably not a major change. Now, there are a couple of things, about Pruitt. One of the most underappreciated things about him is that while it is not debatable that he was deeply committed to rolling back environmental regulations, it is debatable whether he was actually effective at it. There are legal scholars who have pointed out that the EPA has tried to roll back a lot of regulations hastily. They've done it quickly. Some of their efforts have been blocked in court. There are some legal scholars who say that the EPA has failed to do its legwork, failed to dot their I's and cross their T's in their pursuit of rolling back regulations. So that's one thing that, you know, potentially the EPA could become more effective under Pruitt's successor at doing, if that goes forward. And of course, as Kim pointed out, the constant barrage of headlines and you know, scandals and allegations at Pruitt was also causing conservative Republicans who like what Pruitt was trying to do to point out that, you know, maybe he's not the right person to be overseeing this agenda because it's bringing all sorts of negative attention and hindering his efforts.
Another Pruitt question, if I might, Jack Beatty, coming in on an interim basis on Monday, the EPA Deputy Administrator Andrew Wheeler is taking over, former coal industry lobbyist. You think he'll lead the agency similar to the way Pruitt did? Could it be more severe under Andrew Wheeler for environmentalists?
It certainly could be. I mean, in his lobbying career, his clients have been pretty much a rogue's gallery of poisoners of the air, water, and ground. So, yes, he could well make some you know, forge a new frontier there. On the other hand, there was a Democratic senator being interviewed this morning on Morning Edition who seemed to be saying, well, this man at least is responsible, he's at least competent, and we know him. He did work in the Senate for Jim Imhoff, who, of course, as a climate change denier, as I guess Mr. Wheeler is. So, but that was something to hear a Democratic senator say that.
I'm wondering one last question about Pruitt, if I might, since Sahil, you brought this up. Pruitt offered himself as a replacement, as you pointed out, for Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who's been a repeated target of criticisms from President Trump. Do you think there's any chance at this point that Pruitt ends up at the Justice Department?
That seems highly unlikely at this point. If that were to be the case, then I think President Trump would sooner have made the move rather than accepted his resignation. One of the interesting things about that is there seems to be a bit of a mind meld between President Trump and Scott Pruitt in terms of their feelings of victimization, that they're constantly, you know, the president always talks about he's treated unfairly, the media is attacking him unfairly, that sort of thing. And, you know, Pruitt shared that belief, and there are reports that the two of them gossiped about that, and as well as about Jeff Sessions.
All right.
And Bob, if I can make a quick point on that. If one thing that's keeping Jeff Sessions in his job is that right now the Senate could not possibly confirm a successor, I can't think of a worse candidate to try to get through another Senate confirmation right now than Scott Pruitt.
What do you mean the Senate couldn't possibly approve a successor?
Because the Justice Department is so rife right now, that the Senate has such a small, narrow majority. I think one thing that Jeff Sessions is feels pretty content in is the fact that no matter who the president nominates to succeed him at the Justice Department, there would be such an opposition mounted that it would drag on for months. And I don't think that Scott Pruitt could possibly get approved again.
All right. Very quick answer to this question, if I might, Kimberly, from Mean Girl on our website. Do the 13-plus investigations into Pruitt mean that he's at risk of a criminal charge?
Yes. I mean, some of these charges do carry criminal penalties. I don't know if there'll be a less of an appetite to go after him if he's no longer in that position, but yes, it does.
All right. We're talking about the week in the news. Join the conversation. How are you reading the tea leaves for the Supreme Court pick? And coming up next, we're going to talk about the trade war with China. I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Scott Detrow. There is so much political news to follow these days, but you don't have to keep up with all of it. You just have to keep up with us on the NPR Politics podcast. You can find us on the NPR One app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes. We're discussing the week's top stories. Join the conversation. Who heads your list for the next Supreme Court nominee? What do you make of the DNA tests for families separated at the border? Are you confident Secretary of State Mike Pompeo can strike a deal with North Korea before either side strikes out with firepower? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with Kimberly Atkins, Chief Washington Reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's move on to the trade war, which is on as of today. China almost immediately retaliated following the White House move to impose a 25% tariff on $34 billion of Chinese imports to the U.S. Here's the Chinese Commerce Ministry spokesman Gao Feng yesterday saying the U.S. trade tariffs threaten the global economy.
U.S. measures are essentially attacking global supply and value chains. To put it simply, the U.S. is opening fire on the entire world, including itself.
What happens next is pretty much anyone's guess. Analysts say that since both sides have pledged not to back down, and because President Trump has threatened additional tariffs in a week. But in fact, Trump also recently tweeted that trade wars are good and easy to win. That may be what's in his mind, but this is not a universally held opinion, is it, Jack Beatty?
No. And indeed, it may be a unique opinion in the economics profession held by his advisor, Peter Navarro. 6 weeks ago, Mr. Navarro said this: "I don't believe any country will retaliate." Of Mr. Navarro, the Cato Institute, conservative, said his appointment is a fundamental assault on fact and reason. The National Review referred to Mr. Navarro as a crude and ridiculous propagandist. There's a headline, "Peter, Free Trade Leads to Abortions, Navarro." And, you know, this man and Mr. Trump are now making war on the U.S. economy. One estimate, this one from the National Retail Federation, predicts a loss of 134,000 U.S. jobs, net income of farmers, perhaps a decline of 6%, and a loss of 67,000 agriculture jobs. Tariffs will hurt states, the 10 states that will be hit the hardest: California, Texas, Florida, Washington, New York, Georgia, Missouri, Pennsylvania, North Carolina, and Ohio. A lot of red states there. And for American consumers, good news. The television that yesterday you could get for $250 made in China, well, tomorrow or soon, it's liable to be $308.
Well, catch the sales today then before the prices change. Let's hear from On Point listeners. Aaron is calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Aaron.
Hi, Bob.
Go right ahead. You want to talk about the trade war?
Yeah. The trade war is just going to wind up hurting consumers. In the short term, it's going to hurt businesses in China and the U.S., and eventually those costs are going to be passed down to consumers here in the U.S. and in China, and then finally globally.
So what do you think is ahead for the U.S. and China in this dispute, Aaron? What do you think is going to happen?
Well, the U.S. is going to increase tariffs beyond what China can tariff on U.S. goods, and China will have to retaliate in other ways. They've already issued travel warnings in the U.S. They're going to perform other activities that are going to be hostile to the U.S., and not associated directly with trade.
Kimberly Atkins, what are you hearing out of the White House on this or on Capitol Hill?
Yeah, I mean, it is a great concern. Look, I think you have some people who are behind President Trump. His basic theory, and this is something he's believed for decades, this is his basic tenet, is that trade deficits are bad in themselves, and that you have to be tough on trade, you have to protect American companies, and therefore you retaliate when there is a trade deficit and try to strong-arm people into relenting through things like tariffs. Now, while that is not completely completely wrong, that you can use tariffs to sort of pressure people when it comes to trade deficits, usually that's done when you have your allies around you. The president is declaring a trade war on everyone, even our allies. And so in this case, you have the United States standing alone in imposing these tariffs on China, which has made very clear they will retaliate just dollar for dollar when that happens. But we don't have the EU standing behind us. We don't even have Canada standing behind us, because we're in a trade war with all of them too. And I was recently in China, and one Chinese official told me that they are not going to, kneel on their knee while the president holds a gun to their head, that they plan to retaliate. They know that for some of their imports, things like wine, they import a lot of American wine. Well, you know, France and Italy and Spain has nice wine too. They also realize the supply chain for a lot of suppliers is not linear. A lot of U.S. companies depend on Chinese parts. Part of their products are manufactured partially in China or partially in some EU countries, as well as in the United States. So this is automatically the U.S. tariffs are going to hurt American companies in themselves. And finally, China, like other economies, are moving more and more to a service economy. And so it's really unclear how much these initial wave of tariffs, anyway, is going to hurt China. It's certainly not going to bring them to their knees. And if we see an escalation, we will see pain all the way around, including with U.S. companies.
I want to ask an international political question based out of what you were talking about, Kimberly. Considering that there is no love lost between President Trump and China, and no love lost, at least on the trade issue, between President Trump and our allies in Europe, Germany, France, England, I'm wondering if you think the leaders in these nations will resist backing off on their own just to make a political point to President Trump, maybe so steadfast that they would be willing to place their economies at least some slight temporary risk.
I think that's a possibility just by way of the fact that they have numbers. I mean, they're all, the one thing that they all have in common is that they are currently in some sort of trade war in, or some trade dispute in one way or another with the United States. And if they have the numbers on their side, perhaps they will see some strength there in an effort to push back. We might see that happen. I mean, each country has to consider their own economy, of course, and make those decisions in terms of that. But I also think this has a broader impact. This has an impact on things like foreign policy. If you remember, China was one of our key partners in trying to bring Kim Jong-un to the table for whatever agreement that's still unknown but might come out between the talks between the United States and North Korea. So there are a lot of broad implications here. But I think at the end of the day, while this initial opening salvo of the trade war might not in itself really harm companies to the point that consumers really feel in their pocketbooks, an escalation definitely will.
Sahil, weigh in on this.
Sure. So I think the obvious consequence of this trade war is going to be consumers in the United States pay more for goods. Businesses have higher costs for inputs. But of course, some domestic industries here will be protected. And this is the entire point for President Trump. He has spent decades, and I do mean decades, talking about how trade deals are exploiting American workers, that the United States, in his words, makes lousy trade deals. And it's one of the only consistencies in his worldview over the years. Now, one of the political things to keep a close eye on is the fact that China is slapping tariffs on soybeans made in the United States. Now, this is going to have a huge impact in the middle of the country. There are crucial Senate races this fall in states like Missouri and North Dakota and Indiana, which are Republican-leaning states. Republicans have an advantage there, and there are many farmers there who support President Trump and are going to be hit very hard by this because their business model is in many ways designed on the basis of having access to foreign markets, and this limits their access. So I think one of the key things I'm keeping an eye on is whether this Trump voter, who liked, you know, his rhetoric about making the playing field more level for American workers, is going to like the impact of this. I think voters have a tendency to see trade and trade policy with one eye. You see the downsides of it very clearly, right? Shuttered plants, jobs lost in your neighborhood. How many of them see the upsides of it, which is cheaper goods? And, you know, when you go to the store, when you go to the grocery store, when you go to Walmart, and businesses paying less for their inputs, small businesses included. So I think we're going to see a reckoning on this like we haven't before.
So Jack, do you agree with that? Do you think that maybe the only way President Trump backs down on this is if there is political pressure from within his own party, maybe from Capitol Hill, maybe from candidates who are on the ballot in the November elections, if they begin to see support erode in states that Trump won because people employed in those states, like farmers and cattle ranchers, are beginning to feel the impact of the trade dispute?
Well, I see the logic of that. The trouble is the Democratic Party has been, you know, Janus face on this whole business of trade. The intelligentsia in the Democratic Party is very skeptical of trade. You know, they talk about managed trade and free trade has not worked for the America. And in the campaign, Hillary Clinton, who in her bones believed in free trade and globalization, didn't defend it. She backed away from the Pacific Partnership Agreement. So the Democrats are not in a great position to be defending trade. And I think that's a kind of intellectual fault of theirs and a political cowardice, too. And then also, you know, if there's disruption, I think the president has got people to blame. The blame machine is going to be out there, and he'll blame the Democrats, of course. But he's also going to, you know, turn up the heat against immigrants and against the other and all the rest. His parade of horribles that he'll produce, and he'll sort of play polarization politics out of this.
All right, let's hear from another On Point listener, if we might, about trade. Peter is calling from Haddam, Connecticut. Hi, Peter, you're on Point.
Yeah, I think tariffs are a blunt instrument that will cause economic disaster and are not a solution to the unequal playing field. I think we can bring DEP standards to China so that their production process conforms to our environmental regulations for clean air and clean water. I think we need to ensure that their production process conforms to our OSHA standards. These are all things that make production in the United States more expensive than China. There's other reasons as well. Trademarks, copying, unfair ownership deals. Mao Zedong was right. The greed of the capitalist is how we will destroy them. We'll build our new factories in China where they are out from under our control. We've already done this.
But do you think President Trump will back off on this, or that it's going to wing forward into the summer and maybe even into the fall? Peter?
Yes.
I guess.
Say again.
Now, I said, do you think President Trump will back off?
I hope he will take a different course that's a little bit more sophisticated and nuanced.
All right, Peter, thank you very much. Let me ask one more question about this, if I might, because I've kind of avoided it up to this point. Some economists in the U.S. think that a prolonged trade war might tank the stock market, lead to a recession. Others say the U.S. economy can tolerate it. Jack, what's your take or fear about this?
Well, it would be just a fear that it could certainly be have that kind of deleterious consequences. On the other hand, you know, as to paraphrase Adam Smith, there's a great deal of ruin in the American economy. That is, it is so big, it is so various. There's so much going on. Unemployment now is at an almost historic low in at least recent years. It's going to take quite a while, I think, for even a serious trade war to begin to tank the economy.
All right, let's talk about the Supreme Court. President Trump's interviews of candidates to replace retiring Supreme Court Justice Anthony Kennedy are done. The White House says the president will announce his nominee Monday night in an address to the nation at a charity dinner honoring veterans in West Virginia Tuesday night. The president told the crowd he's been working hard to pick Kennedy's successor.
Supreme Court justice is such an important decision, and we're going to give you a great one. We're going to announce it on Monday, and I think you'll be very impressed. These are very talented people, brilliant people, and I think you're going to really love it, like Justice Gorsuch. We hit a home run there, and we're going to hit a home run here.
The three frontrunners are reported to be federal appeals court judges, Brett Kavanaugh, Yale graduate, Raymond Kethledge, University of Michigan graduate, Amy Coney Barrett, former Notre Dame law professor. Kimberly Start, who has the edge here, do you think?
I'm hearing that Brett Kavanaugh is the one to beat at this point. I mean, all of these names came from the list cultivated by conservative legal think tanks, the Heritage Foundation and the Federalist Society. So they're all names that conservatives and evangelicals and those who supported President Trump, some with their noses being held, could love, because they're the exact kind of folks that they want in the federal judiciary. And this is keeping with President Trump's vow to appoint such justices to judges and justices throughout the judiciary. But when it comes to Brett Kavanaugh, it just seemed that throughout the interview process, the president just simply liked him. They had some sort of rapport. He got along very well, liked him. We know that the president operates in that way to some extent through his gut. So I think he is the one to beat at this point. But everyone always says, as if on cue, the president can always change his mind. He can change his mind right up to Monday night when he is expected to make this announcement with some primetime fanfare, the same way that he did when he announced Justice Gorsuch, his first pick to replace the late Antonin Scalia.
Sahil, do you agree, Kavanaugh or someone else?
So our reporting at Bloomberg suggests that Brett Kavanaugh and Raymond Kethledge are the two frontrunners ahead in President Trump's mind of Amy Coney Barrett, who is also very much part of the mix. There is, I think, a little bit in the background, Thomas Hardiman on the Third Circuit. He's a judge. He was a finalist for the seat that eventually went to Neil Gorsuch. But look, all of these judges have much more in common than they have in terms of the differences between them. These are all very conservative judges who have been vetted by very conservative legal advocates who feel burnt by, you know, past nominees, most notably David Souter, who, you know, came of age and who were radicalized a little bit by the very liberal decisions of the, you know, of the Warren Court and in the 1960s and the 1970s. So this has been a movement over decades, and they are very, very, you know, they're one seat away from, I think, having the most conservative Supreme Court since the 1930s in the United States by some studies.
Jack,
and that means abortion, same-sex marriage, affirmative action, and detainee rights, votes where Justice Kennedy sided with the left. I think those are all on the table now.
Jack, give me a line out of this before we go to the break. What is the chief quality you think President Trump is looking for in a candidate?
Oh, somebody who plays very well with his base, his evangelical base, or on the other side, the deep business base that wants to see the First Amendment weaponized as a tool to use against regulation.
More on the Supreme Court coming up after the break. We're discussing the week's top headlines. Join the conversation. Who's your pick for the court? I'm Bob Oakes. This is On Point.
It's not a secret. Parenting is hard. But maybe we shouldn't put so much pressure on ourselves.
To get to good outcomes, sometimes you do better by not worrying about outcomes at all.
I'm Shankar Vedantam, host of Hidden Brain. Join us as we explore two very different models of what it means to raise a human.
This is On Point. I'm Bob Oakes. In other news this week, Patricia Okumu climbed the Statue of Liberty on Independence Day in protest of the separation of migrant families. She borrowed this line from First Lady Michelle Obama.
Our beloved First Lady that I care so much about said, when they go low, we go high. And I went as high as I could.
About 100 feet up on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty, King of Cleveland LeBron James shook the basketball world on Monday. He signed a deal to leave the Cleveland Cavaliers for the L.A. Lakers.
Breaking news, LeBron is a Laker. Leaving Cleveland once again, has agreed to a four-year, $154 million deal with the Lakers.
And Americans across the country celebrated the 4th of July Wednesday. CeCe Winans serenaded the crowd in Washington with God Bless America.
God bless America, my home sweet home.
Join the conversation. Will President Trump be prepared to meet with Russia's Vladimir Putin later this month? What do you want to come out of their one-on-one meeting? What message do you have for the trapped soccer team in the Thai cave? You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. We're speaking with Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter and columnist for the Boston Herald, Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg, and On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Let's go back to the Supreme Court question, if we might, for a couple of minutes. If there's an issue on the ideological spectrum coming before the high court President Trump is most concerned about and looking for a justice, what is it, do you think, Kimberly? Voting rights, Roe v. Wade, something else?
I think it's all of it. I think he would love to be able to say, and he has already bragged about the judiciary, to say that he has had a bigger impact, an impact that's going to last for a long time on the court. I think overall, more than the actual issues themselves, he's purposely looking for people who are very young. He wants his justices to be on the Supreme Court for a very long time. He's looking for people who, in the words of one of his advisors, is tough, you know, can be seen as strong. I think he sees that as reflecting on him. And I think we've already heard him on the campaign trail say, if he's elected, it's a foregone conclusion that Roe v. Wade will be overturned. I think that he knows that his supporters would like to see things like the Voting Rights Act rolled back. I mean, the more Voting Rights Act policies are rolled back, the more we have seen on the ground in states that tends to benefit Republicans. And we have seen him, you know, express some animosity toward policies like affirmative action. That's another thing that would be on the chopping block. I think one interesting point that sort of flies under the radar that could happen with his next appointment is that there's something called Chevron deference, which is a legal principle that judges have to give deference to a federal agency for an interpretation of their own rule or regulation. Well, a lot of justices on the court, including Neil Gorsuch, are pretty hostile to that idea. They said, no, it's the role of judges to decide whether a regulation should stand or not. And given how many of President Trump's rules are coming under federal challenge, under challenges in the courts, if the courts start giving less deference to the administration's own interpretation of those rules, it may make it harder to defend. So on that one small place, Trump may be shooting himself in the foot a little bit, but I think otherwise he'll be quite happy with what the next justice and therefore the entire court does moving forward.
Sahil Kapoor, issues coming before the court in the coming terms that this new justice will weigh in on that Donald Trump is thinking about?
Right. So I would start with campaign finance. There's obviously the 2010 decision, Citizens United, which set the the foundation for a rollback of campaign finance limits. There was a follow-up decision a few years later, I believe called McCutcheon, that continued in that direction. And it is very possible to see Anthony Kennedy's replacement continue along as part of that five-member majority in further curtailing campaign finance limits. There's also gun rights. The Supreme Court has been reluctant to take up cases that could expand gun rights after the major Heller ruling, which found a constitutional right to have a handgun in the home for self-defense. There's the issue of voting rights as well, which could come up again after the Supreme Court made the landmark decision in Shelby County versus Holder to gut a piece of the Voting Rights Act from the 1960s. The biggest issue that everyone is going to have their eye on the Senate confirmation is Roe versus Wade. The last time the Supreme Court tackled this head on was 1992. It affirmed the core holding in Roe versus Wade. And this vote, Anthony Kennedy's replacement, could potentially be the fifth vote to overturn Roe versus Wade, or at least chop it up with a thousand cuts. It's very possible to see the Supreme Court with a Kennedy replacement of a solid conservative fifth vote to uphold state laws that have been pursued in places like Texas and Mississippi that would restrict abortion access throughout the state, essentially, that would, force abortion clinics to shut down. And that is a goal of many legislators there. And I think, even if Roe versus Wade isn't overturned, I think abortion access and abortion rights are very much on the line. And I think we're going to see Democrats demand that this nominee take a position on that. I doubt the nominee eventually will. And senators are going to have to make a decision as to whether that's good enough.
To On Point listeners now, if we might, John is calling from Montpeel, near Vermont. Go ahead, John.
Hello, Bob. John McHugh. I'm just concerned that the Supreme Court, I always thought that they were supposed to be more of philosopher kings, our best and brightest, most intelligent people to make these decisions for us. And yet this discussion seems to be just a political one where are they too conservative, too liberal, not conservative enough, not democratic enough, not Republican enough. Aren't we supposed to be trying to find our best and brightest thinkers in this country to be elected to the Supreme Court?
Jack Beatty, you want to weigh in on this? Certainly President Trump has politics tops in his mind, or at least it seems that way.
Yes, and in fact, he's spoken almost as the Supreme Court, as if it's a branch of his patronage. Elect me and you're going to get these people on the bench. Kimberly could speak to this better, but it seems to me a couple of years ago there was a big quantitative study on this that looked at partisanship and judicial decisions. And what did that find, Kim?
I'm not sure I know the exact study that you're pointing
to, Jack. This is the one I think that basically said if you're appointed by a Democrat, you could predict almost infallibly how you'd vote. And by a Republican, you could predict the vote. And that this was very different from even, say, the Warren Court, where, you had Republican, Warren himself was a Republican. It was different. It was different in the David Souter days. It was different even with someone like Anthony Kennedy, but that more and more judges are in lockstep with the party that appoints them.
Yeah, I mean, and just to add to that, look, I think the Supreme Court, yes, the idea is that it is impartial and that it is removed from politics, and the founders set up the judiciary to be that way. The judiciary has never been completely removed from politics. I mean, years ago when the court was packed and then that decision was struck down, and during the Roosevelt era up until modern day, of course, that ebbs and flows. And we have seen justices like Justice Kennedy and Justice Souter and Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, who did not necessarily vote lockstep with their party. But I think the justices are a product of politics. They are selected by presidents and confirmed by members of the Senate. And at a time today when politics are so polarized, that is reflective in the justices that are being selected. That means that by no means means that these justices are unqualified. But I think that presidents are much more careful to select people who, based on their records and their backgrounds, are going to vote more consistently the way they want them to than would have happened 10 or 20 years ago.
Is there any chance that the Democrats who are going to vote on this along with the Republicans, the Democrats a vote or two short, will be able to block this nominee? And if not, what do you think their strategy will be, Sahil?
Democrats do not have the votes to block this nominee. The confirmation of Neil Gorsuch led Republicans to use the so-called nuclear option in the Senate to eliminate the 60-vote threshold for Supreme Court nominees. It had previously been eliminated for lower court and executive nominees by Democrats several years ago. So Democrats have 49 votes in the Senate, and Republicans have 51, likely to be 50 because Senator McCain has been absent as he fights cancer. Now, all Republicans need is to hold their own ranks together. The two crucial votes that people have their eye on here are Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski, the two most moderate Republican senators. They both have been supportive in their own way of abortion rights, at least on some level. And this, you know, they're going to have a spotlight on them because this, again, as I mentioned moments ago, could be the fifth vote to undo or significantly curtail Roe versus Wade. Now, as for President Trump, I spoke to one of his former advisors who said the president has a bias for people who look like judges. He also really wants people from top schools. This person says they never really got a sense that the president was too into judges beyond, the kind of the good press they could provide and the addition to his legacy that they could provide, especially as it relates to having conservatives who had been skeptical of him or who like him, you know, happy with him.
Kimberly, I want to ask one last question on the Supreme Court, if I might, to you. You just wrote about Maine Senator Susan Collins, Democrats trying to influence her. She's expressed concerns, as Sahil was talking about Roe v. Wade. But is there much of a chance at all that she won't vote for this nominee?
Yeah, I think Democrats themselves see this as a Hail Mary. I think Sahil is absolutely right. Democrats have very little, if any, ability to stop this nominee. We have seen Susan Collins in the past when it comes to judicial nominees or other key votes express a lot of concerns, but at the end of the day, generally go with the Republicans in her vote. There is a sense from the folks I talked to that as Senator Collins will go, Senator Lisa Murkowski will follow. So either on a long shot, they both will vote against this nominee, but the greater chance is that they will. And we also have seen Senator Rand Paul give some concern about Judge Kavanaugh expressing that he is not quite doctrinal or conservative enough. I think at the end of the day, we will see him also fall in line and that this will be a very close, but it'll be good enough to install whoever the president selects onto the court.
And I could briefly add, Bob, Susan Collins has offered up an interesting test here for on the issue of Roe versus Wade. She said the nominee must not have expressed demonstrated hostility to the decision. The key word there is demonstrated. If there's no paper trail, if there's no public record of this person attacking Roe versus Wade, and even if it is someone known to be very conservative and known to have pro-life views, my expectation is she will vote yes.
So does that knock Kavanaugh, Kethledge, or Amy Coney Barrett out?
I don't believe any of those three have a significant paper trail of hostility to Roe versus Wade, even though I think the people who have vetted them do not believe they are, you know, they are fond of that decision.
All right. On to the Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, who's in North Korea trying to push the nuclear deal with North Korea, if we want to call it a deal, forward in some way. On Sunday, White House National Security Advisor John Bolton told CBS's Face the Nation, if Pyongyang cooperates, the U.S. could dismantle North Korea's weapons of mass destruction within a year.
We have developed a program. I'm sure that Secretary of State Mike Pompeo will be discussing this with the North Koreans in the near future about really how to dismantle all of their WMD and ballistic missile programs in a year. If they have the strategic decision already made to do that and they're cooperative, we can move very quickly.
So, Jack Beatty, what does the Trump administration want or might get out of this meeting with that Pompeo's having in North Korea? Will it get verification from the North that it's actually moving to end the nuclear weapons program, or at a minimum that it'll come up with a list of what it has and where they're located, which some armament experts say should at least be the immediate minimum?
Yes, that's what a Korea expert said on Morning Edition this morning, that that would, you know, a list would be the best outcome, or the best possible outcome. I just think they're looking for some face-saving, something to save face after the news of the last couple of weeks that the North has been, you know, re-energizing its nuclear work and missile work and so on, and which is a grave embarrassment for Mr. Trump, who said when he came back the North Korea nuclear threat is over. Well, it's not.
All right, let me ask a question about the separation of children at the border. If I might, the Federal Department of Health and Human Services now says that 3,000 kids have been separated, not the just over 2,000 previously reported, which raised questions for a lot of people this week. Was the government deliberately underreporting previously, or maybe even more concerning, it might not actually have an accurate count at all? Sahil, what are your thoughts on this?
Right. Well, this has become an extraordinary headache for the Trump administration, which implemented its zero tolerance policy months ago. Now, the messaging surrounding it was bungled from the start. But Attorney General Sessions and Chief of Staff John Kelly had explained this to be a policy of deterrence. In other words, we're going to treat people harshly if they sneak through the border. And we're going to send a message to people that, you know, that they must not do this. Now, in terms of the 3,000 kids who have who the government says have been separated, there's a federal judge who has ordered the government to reunite children under age 5 with their parents by this coming Tuesday and to reunite all minors by July 26th. It is not clear that the government is on its way to doing that. I think HHS has been slow to release details. I think this was done without necessarily a plan put together to keep these families together. And there's some reports that records were previously destroyed or not well kept. So this is a debacle that seems likely to persist in the coming weeks and potentially months.
Kimberly, let me ask you a last question for the program today on this subject quickly, if you might. Do you think the White House is at all concerned about the court deadline? Do you think the court deadline might come and go, not all kids reunited with parents, and the White House will say, well, we tried really, really hard?
Yeah, I think logistically, I don't see how they can make that deadline. I mean, the one for very small children, it's coming up in just a matter of days, and the other just weeks after that. I think the White House and the president himself is banking on the fact that a strong immigration policy is the best thing for it politically, and that is more important than meeting this deadline.
All right, now we say goodbye. Kimberly Atkins, chief Washington reporter, columnist for the Boston Herald, thank you. Sahil Kapoor, national political reporter for Bloomberg, thank you very much. On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack. Thank you. You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. And you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm Bob Oakes.